The House will come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
It's pretty much a tradition now that Washington State Speaker of the House Lori Jenkins pays a visit to Capitol Ideas around this time of year to talk about the just concluded legislative session and whatever else comes up. That's a string that continues here in the spring of 2024, so don't touch that dial. First, though, for orientation purposes, I need to say that Capitol Ideas is the podcast where members of the Majority Democratic Caucus in the Washington State House of Representatives, like Speaker Jenkins, sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas. I could tick off some of those ideas and mention that they're united by the fact that they're good ideas, reflecting Democratic values, but instead I'll just let you hear that for yourself, straight from the Speaker. We recorded this not long after the 2024 legislative session ended on time with a no new taxes budget, and here's how that conversation went. Welcome back to Capitol Ideas, Speaker of the House, Lori Jenkins. It's always a kick to talk to you.
It's good to see you too, Dan.
I think the last time we talked was almost exactly a year ago, and it was at the end of the 2023 session, which means it's now the end of the 2024 session. It's the end of the 23/24 biennium. And one of the things I would love for you to do is kind of give us an overview of what 23/24 was like from your point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Dan, as a biennium, we made a lot of progress, and we also saw how much more progress we need to make. For example, we made investments in housing that are historic by magnitudes, by multiples of what we've invested in before, both the housing trust fund and our capital budget, but also our missing middle housing bill, Mia Gregerson's bill this year on ADUs. And so we've done a lot of stuff, but the need for housing in this state is far outpacing what we're able to build. And I think one of the things that we really want to continue working on in the House is figuring out how we can bring more predictability and stability for renters. Over 35% of Washingtonians are renters. That's a huge percentage of our population. And they just don't have any predictability in terms of how to manage their rent. You know, for you and I assume that you own your home. We still have a mortgage, but we own our, you know, we're going to own it someday. But we know for 30 years how much we're going to pay every single month. And renters don't know that. So I think that's a piece of work to do. That's something we've done. I'm already getting off on a it's not a sidetrack, but all details about housing. The other thing that I would just say about these issues is that they've become so much more intertwined than historically we've seen them. So issues around behavioral health, both mental health treatment and substance use disorder, you know, certainly contribute to housing and homelessness issues. And so we see these connections all the time. Again, we're making finally able to both make big investments in what I call the deep end of the pool in behavioral health, which is really, you know, Western State Hospital and folks who are civilly committed because they can't really care for themselves, or folks who have engaged in some sort of criminal activity, but they aren't mentally competent to stand trial. We're doing work there, which we have been for many, many years, but we're making progress in terms of bed availability. But the place where we had less progress was just basic community-based mental health care. And we're really making progress there by increasing our investments in workforce there, finding ways to improve or bring more people into the workforce to help in our communities. So I think that's going really well. And then in the 2024 session, fentanyl really became a focus, opioids and especially fentanyl. And we had a package of about 10 different bills doing everything from education to intervention and treatment for folks who were suffering with a substance use disorder, fentanyl disorder. One of the challenges with fentanyl is it's not a disorder that people have for a really long time. It kills you very quickly, and we want to save people's lives. Our work on fentanyl is very important, and it's the first time really that I feel like we have had a community that has been extraordinarily impacted by fentanyl deaths. That's our tribal communities in Washington State. They have really been leading the way in advocating for more treatment, more education, and we really followed their lead this year, and our investments were a lot in tribal communities. And what's nice is our tribal communities are not just treating tribal members, they treat the whole community that they live in. So, you know, maybe 20% of the folks that they treat in their facilities are tribal members. The other 80% are other community members. So their willingness to use the knowledge that they've developed through having, you know, really an extraordinarily high number of deaths in their community is something I'm really grateful for.
Part of your background is in public health, so I think you're eminently qualified to answer this. What does a community-based solution look like physically versus a state hospital like Western State?
Well, if I really go back into my real public health beliefs, that would be strong prevention. And really strong prevention means that you're providing resources to families at the birth of a child in order to help the family be strong and help kids be raised in healthy ways and to help provide parents what they need in order to be able to do that, which also includes good jobs, housing, and the supports for childcare and daycare centers and early learning experiences. All the research says that those interventions early on are the most important for a person's whole, to have an impact on a person's whole life. Now, when you become an adult, many folks will need either medication or therapeutic intervention. And a lot of communities, like here in Tacoma where I live, we have comprehensive mental health, as well as other mental health treatment providers, where folks can both be seen and get medicated interventions, as well as therapeutic interventions, have people provide supports there. And then we have housing, in which we provide supportive housing for people who have really, really serious mental illness, and in order to stay stable in their housing, need some supports around them. It's been very interesting because the research around this says that if you could only provide one thing, either medication for people or housing, you'd provide them housing. Now, you don't want to just have to choose between those. It's better. Sure. People's outcomes are better if they have all of these services. Yeah. But housing stability has a huge impact on somebody's ability to live a healthy life.
So what I'm hearing, for one thing, is that I was going to ask you about priorities for the 25-26 biennium, and I think we've already got one taken care of right there.
Yes. I mean, absolutely. That's why I said in the beginning, Dan, that we made so much progress on these areas, and the thing that the progress tells us is we uncovered more that we need to do. And so I don't expect, I mean, there's a long time between now and when the 2025 session starts, but I don't expect we'll see these things fall off the radar. Housing, behavioral health work, both on the substance use disorder side and on the mental health side. I only mentioned just briefly childcare and early learning. It's the most important thing for our kids' development. And what we see is families not being able to afford childcare, and we see businesses not basically losing members of the workforce because members of their workforce can't get childcare. So we had a study a few years ago that said that Washington businesses lose about $2 billion a year because of parents who have to stay home from work because they can't find childcare. So this is a place where our business community, our families, our nonprofit community, the legislature, we are all aligned to want to provide childcare for folks and early learning. I think one of our biggest challenges this year is going to be the way we've paid for that with our capital gains tax, which is paid by about 4,000 people of the over 7 million people who live in Washington State. Very small number of people pay it. It's mostly a tax that you pay if you trade stocks and bonds and earn more than $250,000 trading right. stocks and bonds. But there's an initiative to repeal that tax.
The childcare crisis seems like it would be something that hit small business extremely hard compared to Boeing or Microsoft or another huge employer that can either pay their people higher salaries or they can afford to have on-site childcare.
Yeah, I mean, right, if you're a small business, it's going to be very hard for you to have to create a daycare in your small business. Larger companies, that's something that they're definitely doing, is opening daycares within their facilities. So again, providing community-based childcare resources in every community across the state so that folks who want to work in a small business, work in a large business, who want to work outside the home can do that. I mean, really what you want to do is have supports. As we go back to your earlier question about my public health background, what we want to do is have support for people and for families so that everyone can engage in community the way they want to and help community in the way they want to and help their family in the way they want to. But, you know, most families nowadays, including my own, our son just graduated college, but most families, both parents need to work. And we have a lot of single parent households. So again, that creates real challenges in terms of affordability and flexibility for families.
How about climate change? How's that for switching gears?
Well, that when you asked at the very beginning, you know, what were the big issues? Climate was the other thing that I was going to raise. Washingtonians and the legislature, I think the legislature has kind of followed the lead of residents and voters in Washington by engaging heavily on climate change and working hard to try to move away from carbon emissions and doing the things that we can to help individual homeowners and individual drivers and folks in all sorts of ways to do the individual things that they want to do so people can do their part to decrease the amount of carbon that they individually put into the environment. But our job is really to create systems. It is an individual responsibility, but it's also a systemic responsibility. So we need to do things that are making sure that we're not encouraging more carbon production in Washington State. And I think we've done a good job of doing that. You know, I'll tell you, in the last couple of the years, one of the pieces of work we've done is on buildings and on construction of buildings. I'm a healthcare person. I've always worked in healthcare. I understand climate and healthcare interact, but I haven't been that knowledgeable about the policies around climate. That hasn't been my area of my activism. But to find out how much building construction really contributes and the ways we construct buildings and the materials we use in buildings and all sorts of things, the huge amount that they contribute to carbon being released into our communities was surprising to me. And so sometimes those seem like obscure, strange little bills that and they have huge impacts. One of the things I've been very happy to see in the last few years is how both the business community and the fossil fuel industry have really come on board more and more with understanding the need to move to a green energy economy and with really creative ways to do that. I wouldn't say everybody's there, but we continue to move in that direction, and it's great to see it be more collaborative as time goes by rather than a conflict-oriented space.
Are you talking about Washington-based businesses here or the multinationals?
Well, both in some ways. Like I think about the Climate Commitment Act, which we passed a couple of years ago, and which most of the international fossil fuel companies very much opposed. And now most of those fossil fuel companies are very much in favor of the Climate Commitment Act, and now that they understand how it works, are also changing their business model to try to emit fewer fossil fuels. Again, I'm not saying everybody's in a perfect position, but it is good to see people shifting into this green energy economy. We see it in the labor workforce also moving into, let's build green energy instead of holding on to some of those jobs that really contributed in a significant way toward climate change. And so we see these shifts happening. And part of it was just a few years ago, people had a vision about what you could do, but it wasn't really clear that you could do it. And now that many of those visions have been put into action, people start to see, yes, this will work. This will work. Yes, we can transition.
Other than these, I'll call them the big four, there was lots and lots of issues that came before you as the Speaker of the House and the legislature this year. What do you feel like are some of the, I won't call them minor victories, because some of them may affect lots and lots of people, but some of the smaller victories?
One thing that I consider to be very large victory is our continued commitment to reproductive health, to abortion services, to gender-affirming care here in Washington State. And I think it's a hallmark for this biennium. Some of the bills that we passed last year after the Supreme Court struck down a woman's right to choose nationally, luckily here in Washington State, we have had voters who have always supported a woman's right to choose. But what we saw is states across the country who had very different viewpoints wanting to go after women and doctors who were providing the services, wanting to come into Washington State and do that. We heard stories, for example, from hospitals in Washington State where there were actually bounty hunters from the state of Texas. There's a lawsuit going on right now between Children's Hospital and the state of Texas where bounty hunters were there trying to determine what a physician who might be licensed in both Texas and Washington was doing, as well as what patients were doing, and to try to have them criminally charged in Texas. We passed legislation to make sure that that would never happen here in Washington, so we feel really good about our protective services. But also this year, even though we weren't, again, able to do everything we wanted to do, we've seen book bans all over the country. And these are frequently book bans raised by kind of a political viewpoint. And Monica Stonier had a great bill that creates standards and requires school districts to have standards in place about how they will screen books. It's very important that parents understand and know what their kids are learning in school, that our law already says that parents have the ability to opt kids out of, you know, sexual health education and things like that, but also that parents be involved in the curriculum and can review the curriculum. But you shouldn't be able to prohibit a book just because you don't like it and others think it would be very helpful for their children, right? There ought to be a process in place. So I'm very pleased with that piece of legislation that Monica Stonier got to the governor's desk.
That's Majority Floor Leader Monica Stonier.
Yes.
How about community safety? That was a big issue. It's always a big issue.
Yeah. People might know there was an initiative to the legislature that we passed this year that essentially lets local jurisdictions decide what limits they want to place on police pursuits. Although it does keep in place many, many of the requirements that we put in place a couple of years ago, such as notifying adjoining jurisdictions if you're engaging in a pursuit, in a high-speed pursuit, getting the approval of your superiors before you engage in something like that. When we had the hearing on the initiative, we heard that these are all best practice standards. Here in Tacoma, where I live, essentially law enforcement has by policy that the police department adopted a policy a number of years ago in which they don't engage in high-speed pursuits because they recognize how dangerous they are to civilians. But it does, the bill we passed lets other jurisdictions kind of go about that process of figuring out what they should be doing in their community on a community-by-community basis. And, you know, hopefully we'll continue to have communities all over the state deciding to engage in best practices there. The other places where I think we've made huge progress are in training more police officers. We've opened up many, many training facilities across Washington State. So we just opened one in Vancouver. We've had one open in Pasco. We're working on getting one opened in the Skagit Valley area. The current Criminal Justice Training Commission is in Burien. Their classes have expanded. And one of the amazing things that has happened, well, it's not amazing because it's what we theorized would happen. So I guess we're being proven true, is we're getting much more diverse individuals applying to go into these academies, more women, more people of color. And what we are finding is that, for example, on the opening day of session, I met a police officer who had just graduated from the Pasco Training Academy, Latina woman. And she told me that she would not have been able to go through the academy because of family needs had she had to come to Burien to do that. But she was able to do it in Pasco. She's now going to be able to serve as a law enforcement officer in her community. And we see the diversity of people applying and wanting to go into law enforcement all over the state because we have opened up these sites. And then I realize this is a long answer, Dan, but the other thing I'm really proud of is I think we've engaged in really smart policy choices. So a few years ago, I'm sure you remember this, you couldn't have a day go by in which there weren't reports of catalytic converter thefts in every community in the state of Washington.
It was every day.
Yeah. Yeah, and we were very concerned about that, and so we did some looking at what was happening nationally, things that were working, and Cindy Ryu had a bill that we passed, which instead of saying, oh, well, it's already criminal to steal a catalytic converter, we're just going to make it more criminal, that hasn't been shown to actually really decrease the rate of thefts when you do things like that. She said, we need to focus on the secondary market. Who's buying these stolen catalytic converters? And so we passed a bill that required anyone who purchased a catalytic converter to have proof that the person they purchased it from was the owner. This year, we saw a 70% decrease in catalytic converter thefts in Washington State. That is smart. That is the way we want to be thinking about how we, you know, stop certain behaviors, encourage others, is do smart law enforcement techniques and policy bills on these topics. The thing that we see is that the folks who really make a lot of money on catalytic converter thefts are what are called consolidators. So Rep. Ryu had a bill this year in which we did increase the penalties for consolidators, people who were purchasing and then reselling. I think it was more than 7 or 10 catalytic converters at a time, because those people are fairly clearly consolidating converters that are being stolen, then reselling them. So again, we're trying to do really smart interventions that actually have the effect that people want to have, rather than just make people feel good, but maybe don't actually have the effect that people want. So that's how we've been focusing our work.
We've been talking about policy, which is obviously what the state legislature makes, but you've also got a job there, which is being Speaker of the House. This has been 4 or 5 years now that you've had this job title, and I wonder, what do you know now that you didn't know the day that they said, hey, you won that election, you're going to be Speaker of the House?
Almost everything. I mean, I would say it's one of the most, I've had a lot of jobs in my life and I've loved every single one of them. This is one of the most vexing jobs I've ever had. And when I say that, what I mean is that it's just really challenging almost all the time. There are policy issues that you have to deal with, political issues that you have to deal with. Administrative, the speaker really there is a chief clerk who is the main administrative person, but that chief clerk reports to me, so you're responsible for running the place. When I became speaker, it was really important to people that we transform and kind of modernize the way the House operated, and we have done some of that, but we still have more to do. But I like the vexing nature of it. I like the challenges. One of the things I've been saying to people more and more, I think it's both the speaker job and being in the House or an elected member. You can become more masterful at the job. You can never master the job. And that's a great kind of job to have.
It seems like part of that is because the cast of characters is constantly changing and the inventory of problems that are being handed to you to help solve are constantly changing.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. I was just talking to someone yesterday about term limits. And I said, you know, in Washington, I think one of the fundamental reasons we don't really need them is that about 20% of the legislature turns over every cycle. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. But if you're in a workplace where you had 20% turnover every 2 years, people would worry that that was actually too much to retain institutional knowledge. I think it's been good. That has been good for us as you bring in new members with new ideas. It's very funny, is you'll see them bring in what they think of as very new ideas. And then for me, as somebody who's been in the legislature now for 14 years, sometimes I'll say to them, yeah, I had that bill once. It didn't pass. Here's what I did. Don't do that again. you know, but a lot of what happens is timing and readiness for ideas. I think about when I entered the legislature and the interest in addressing gun violence was just starting to take root. And now the very strong interest in addressing gun violence, and every year we pass legislation that does really significant work on addressing gun violence in Washington State. And that's the reason why we were rated as having the safest schools in the nation. This last year was in part because of the work that we've done on gun violence. But bills that maybe I had filed early in my career that went nowhere, there's a lot more interest in them now. And it's because of the shifts in both members, but in the population and what the population expects of us.
Gun violence tends to be one of those issues that skews partisan in general, which is my odd way of leading into an observation, I think, that I can make, which is that you occasionally will help Republicans pass their bill.
Yeah. I think good ideas should prevail. Here's the thing. Republicans represent more geography in the state of Washington than Democrats do, not more voters. Democrats represent more voters, but we have tended to represent the more urbanized parts of the state. But the issue is really trying to help every Washingtonian. And we've had great bills by Republicans. You know, I worked a lot. For me, I've been an insulin-dependent type 1 diabetic since I was a child. I'm coming up soon on my 50th anniversary of being diabetic. But I worked with Jacqueline Maycumber, who has a child who's diabetic. It was Jacqueline and I who really started working in the House on $35 for insulin and then making sure that that stayed permanent and other supports for diabetics to make sure that they had access to the drugs that they needed. We have a really long and rich history in Washington of bipartisanship and of focusing on good ideas and not saying, well, we don't care what your idea is because we don't like your, you know, we don't like your party or something like that. I brag a lot, Dan, because this year, for example, I think we had 80% of the bills that we passed were widely, widely bipartisan, meaning that there's 98 of us, over 80 members voted for over 80% of the bills that we passed. High bipartisanship in Washington State, and that's something we should be proud of.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I think if people only focus on the other Washington.
We are the same in name, and that's about as far as it goes. But, you know, that is one thing I definitely have taken from former Speaker Frank Chop. He talked a lot about one Washington and that we should try, the work that we do should try to unify this state, and we should try to address everyone's needs. Now, one of the things that we've learned over the last number of years is that when you try to address everyone's needs in a single piece of legislation, you are always leaving certain people out. And that's why it's important to kind of disaggregate and to understand what different communities need, both by geography, by race, by gender, immigration status, all sorts of things like that. Business community, folks who work in the government sector, there are lots of ways that we can divide each other up and make sure that we're meeting needs of particular communities. But what we don't want to do is divide things up and pit ourselves against one another. We want to help raise everyone's boats.
Madam Speaker, I hate to say this, but I know you've got another engagement here and we've got to cut this off. I hate to disappoint the people that are listening. I hate to disappoint you. I hate to disappoint myself, but I'm going to do that and give you one chance right now to just say, how do you want to go out of this conversation, knowing that there's going to be lots more?
Yeah. You know, Dan, I'll kind of end this conversation by the way I started it, which is I'm really proud of the work that we've done. But I think one of the hallmarks of being a legislator and a policymaker, and I guess certainly a hallmark for me as a person, is that I don't usually dwell too much on the good things that we've done. I'm happy that we've done them, but I'm always focused on what is it that we need to do for people now? What more do we need to do? And again, I think this biennium has been one in which we've made so much progress, and that progress has helped us see how much more we need to do. And I'm excited to be able to do it.
We've been speaking with Speaker of the House Laurie Jenkins on Capital Ideas. This has been a great too short conversation. Thank you, Laurie.
Thanks, Dan.
I hope that half hour with Speaker Laurie Jenkins made you feel good. I know I enjoyed it. You can get that feeling on a regular basis by subscribing to Capital Ideas. It's easy to do at the usual places, or you can go straight to the House Democratic Caucus webpage at housedemocrats.wa.gov and click on the Media tab at the top of the page. That's also where you can poke through the Capital Ideas archives and see what else you might want to listen to, and I hope you will. As we always say at this point, what we talk about here on Capital Ideas is your state government, and what happens here matters. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, putting people first since 1889, the year Charlie Chaplin was born, the Eiffel Tower was opened, and Washington became a state. Thanks for listening.